Welcome back to the John Curley and Sherry Elicker Show. Thanks so much for joining us. We'd love to hear from you. Why don't you text us 1-888-973-5476, or you can write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can always like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Sherry and John. John taking a day off today, so joining us is Cairo Radio's resident historian, Felix Bunnell. Felix, this is not an easy story to talk about. It's been all over the news, and it's just a tragic, horrible, horrible story. It's about a 10-year-old girl in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. She was murdered by a 14-year-old boy who's now been charged as an adult. Apparently, they knew each other. He followed her home. She was walking on a trail, and he murdered her. Let's take a listen.
He's accused of murdering her. He's technically correct. Accused at this point. So yeah.
That's right. He is a suspect in the murder of this young lady. WCCO has the latest on the case.
The juvenile arrested for the murder of Lily Peters appeared in court via video from a juvenile detention center in Eau Claire. We are not showing his face as part of a court order, and his name was not released. The criminal complaint is also sealed. District Attorney Wade Newell told Judge Lane that the 14-year-old defendant, referred to only as CPB, told law enforcement he went with Lily Peters on the walking trail Sunday with the intent to rape and kill her.
When he did get off of the trail, punched the victim in the stomach, knocked her to the ground, essentially strangled her, hit her with a stick before strangling her to the point of death before he then sexually assaulted her.
The 14-year-old suspect faces three felony charges, first-degree murder and two charges of sexual assault. Two of the charges have a maximum penalty of life in prison. The defendant, who law enforcement say knew Lily, has dark hair and kept his head down during the hearing. He did not address the court. His attorneys asked for a $100,000 bail.
He is 14 and an eighth grader. He cannot drive.
But the prosecutor wanted a $1 million cash bond, which the judge granted. Multiple law enforcement sat in the gallery of the courtroom. It did not appear any of Lily's family were present.
I try and be the prosecutor. I would want if something happened to my daughter. And so that's the way I look at things and not try to get too emotionally impacted on it, but just be professional and do what is necessary to have justice done.
The reason that this went automatically to the adult court, Felix, is because in the state of Wisconsin, it's a very, very low age. Anyone over the age of 10 that has been charged with murder, it automatically goes to adult court. In most other states, the age is more like 14 or 15, but in Wisconsin, it's only 10 years old.
Yeah, and there's more than 100 people currently serving life sentences in Wisconsin who committed the crimes they're charged with and convicted of and sentenced for as juveniles. So, boy, the 14-year-old, I mean, any age doing this, but a 14-year-old doing what's been described in the court papers and everything, God only knows what the backstory that will emerge. And there's already, obviously, there's a big detail that's emerging in the backstory now, but who knows what other sick, dysfunctional background that kid had. There must have been. I mean, I'm not excusing him for it because obviously, well, but can you hold a 14-year-old responsible? I mean, is that 14-year-old responsible for what he's accused of doing in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I think he is. I mean, I think that if it was premeditated, it sounds as though he has had discussions indicating that, then yes. Yeah. Whether or not the Supreme Court ruled that it is cruel and unusual punishment to keep a child, you know, in prison for their entire life without the possibility of parole. So that was decided a few years ago. So I think that there is absolutely a case to be made for someone to get a second chance. But he's 14, he's not four. I think that, you know, if in fact he did plan this out, and again, this will all come out in court, then yes, absolutely. An interesting other really sad fact came out today, which is that his dad served 3 years in prison for child pornography. In 2020, though, he sent a letter to the judge and he asked him to please, if he could have unsupervised visits with this his son, the kid that's being accused of this. He described his son as the best of me. The father was convicted in 2017 on 10 counts of child pornography and one count of drug paraphernalia. He has to be on the registry, the sexual offender registry in Wisconsin until 2039. Is that a factor in all of this? Who knows? Who knows what the child's defense will be as far as, you know, what circumstances led up to him, you know, feeling this kind of rage or feeling whatever he felt to cause him to do this. They can ask the court to take it back to juvenile court and see if there's a possibility that that they might be able to have him tried as a juvenile and only do, you know, until he's 21 or whatever they
18,
negotiate.
21. Yeah.
So just a horrible, sad case all the way around.
Multiple tragedies. Of course, the 10-year-old, obviously, that she's the victim and her family is suffering. But this kid, obviously, I mean, there's something wrong with a 14-year-old who does this. And obviously, there's something wrong with his father already. So there's probably several layers of dysfunction and abuse and God knows what else that led to, contributed to this. But boy, a 14-year-old being sentenced to something, life without parole, that's, wow. I mean, I understand, though. God, ugh.
Yeah, I mean, he will have an opportunity for parole. I think that's a given. But when? I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, if somebody is in prison, say he's in prison for 50 years, that's his life. That is the community that he knows. That is the life that he knows. He won't know anything different from that. And to get out when you're, say, in your 50s, to do what? I mean, that's the thing is, yeah. It's not just one life. It's two lives now that are pretty well gone.
Or you think about, you know, it's sending a 10-year-old off with a 14-year-old, and you don't think this would be anything that would be within anyone's, you know, physical vocabulary or whatever to what this 14-year-old is accused of doing. Just, ugh, man.
No, it is a really horrifying story, and much more will certainly be coming out as they move forward with this case. Shifting gears here, I understand, and I heard a rumor about you, Felix. Well, the one I'm going to tell right now, not that other one, is that you're quite the Twitter guy, that you're one that really keeps up and tweets a lot. Is true or false about Felix?
I didn't know that until Jacob told me that earlier today. I didn't think of myself as a Twitter guy.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about, now I feel bad because I don't know, it almost you almost seemed offended when I raised that to you, Felix. Like it's it wrong to be on Twitter that much?
The Scarlet Twitter.
No, I will say, you know, there are plenty of people. I was mostly comparing you to your compatriots within the Cairo building, and there's I think I was just thinking of you in that upper tier of people who are actually on Twitter and use it in a fun way, and you were one of the people I thought. So I didn't mean it in any demeaning way. I apologize.
No, I didn't take it that way. Okay. No, but I use it only for work. I just, you know, I tweet links to stories or photographs related to stories I'm working on. Just kind of keep it interesting because I only get to be on the radio twice a week. So there's 5 days where I'm just sitting all by myself craving attention. And so Twitter is a way to kind of scratch that attention itch by sending stuff out to try to get people to, you know, to give me a like or a retweet or something. It's just the desperate moves by a desperate man.
I understand that. That approval seeking can really get exhausting. And at least you admit it, though. So they did a survey of 112 metro areas. Where do you think Seattle ranked in terms of Twitter uses?
Shocking?
Out of 112? Metro area.
I was shocked.
What do you think that? Oh, you know
I was
this.
Completely shocked. I know the answer. Yeah, I was completely shocked that we're number two.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
And,
Raleigh,
but
North Carolina.
I was even more shocked that number one is Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah. How about it?
that doesn't make any sense.
I don't understand what it is about Raleigh, North Carolina that makes them tweet so much. I don't know. I've never been there. So maybe they have more time on their hands. Maybe they have more interesting stories. But Seattle is number two, Atlanta, Boston, and then Durham, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Facebook actually had more visitors. And they say about three quarters of Seattle residents are on Facebook. But yeah, number two in tweeting. I guess, you know, I don't really do it. I have, in fact, just today, after reading this article, I went on my Twitter page account. I don't even know what I should call it.
Yeah, did I reveal myself? Was this a printed out piece of paper you're looking at?
Anyway, somebody had set it up for me because I had a little role on the show Veep. And so somebody said, you should tweet out that you're going to be on Veep tonight. So way back then, somebody set this account up for me, right? I never really did anything except tweeted that out and maybe whatever. So today I go to look at it and see how I this person described me. And it's like, oh no, it's like actor, comedian, lover of puppies. That's what it said. So I quickly had to go in and like change my profile. And then I had to figure out how to write the whole Cairo thing. So I went to Dory's Twitter thing and looked at his. And yeah. So, I mean, I'm just a Twitter mess. I can't seem to get it together. So I got to get on it.
It's more of a guy thing, at least in Seattle anyway. 54% of the of men in Seattle are on Twitter, or 54% of the users of Twitter in Seattle are men. So it's a guy thing.
I think it kind of is, really. I don't have a lot of girlfriends that I know that tweet a lot of stuff. My friend Molly does it a lot because she does a lot of funny, like tweets out a lot of funny stuff. So I gotta take care of that. Are you worried about Kamala Harris? You know, she's got the COVID. She's
a heartbeat away.
That's right. So
I'm worried about Kamala Harris because she's disappeared. I haven't heard anything about her in the news for the last couple months until she got COVID. She's kind of keeping a low profile, which is different than what I thought she was going to be doing here in this first couple of years of the Biden administration. So maybe COVID is her chance to really rise and shine.
Well, I think part of the reason they may be keeping her, she's not had a wild success with being out, you know, front and center because she's had several missteps in some things that she's done. But she's quarantining now. But there's a little bit of controversy over this because it was announced that even though she said she had no symptoms, that she's taking something called Paxlovid, which is the antiviral drug for people that have COVID. And you don't really hear about many people taking it. And it's supposed to be reserved for people with severe symptoms or if they are at risk. Here is a clip of Jen Psaki talking about that.
The vice president just got her second booster shot. She has no symptoms. Can you help us understand why she's taking it?
Well, he also said, which you didn't include in your summary there, but that you should consult with your doctor. And she consulted with her doctor. She has been given Paxlovid. That's something many Americans may be eligible for. They should also consult with their doctor. And I think overall, we're just grateful that this is an approved drug on the market that many people can benefit from, including the vice president.
Do you know why the vice president's doctor recommended she take Paxlovid?
Well, I think as Dr. Jha said yesterday, there are a range of Americans who may not know they're eligible and they should consult with their doctor. That's exactly what she did. And one of the, not challenges, but one of our efforts right now is to provide more information publicly and have more people consult with their doctors about whether they're eligible.
So a lot of people are confused about this. Have you known of anybody that has had COVID and that has taken this drug, Felix?
I've known plenty of people who've had COVID, and my daughter had pretty serious symptoms, and I haven't heard of anyone getting access to this prescription medicine, which seems like a really good thing. But I think the bigger issue for me is that they'll look back on this pandemic as a case study in how not to communicate during a pandemic. I mean, every possible misstep around spreading the good news about vaccines or how to use masks or how to do social distancing. Well, maybe they got the social distancing right 2 years ago. But this just seems like a huge stumble where there's this medication that's out there that apparently is very effective if you're in the category of over a certain age or susceptible to certain immunity issues. This is a thing that can really reduce the symptoms and increase your chances of recovering more fully. But I don't have the first clue where to get. If I got sick, if I got COVID and came down with symptoms, I don't know what I would do to get a hold of a prescription of this stuff. It just seems like it's a mystery. Everything about this pandemic has been do-it-yourself. You've had to get real answers. You've had to go online and, you know, look what real experts were saying and look at three or four different sources and then try to, you know, interpolate what made the most sense. It's been crazy.
Well, there has been a lot of confusion about this drug, and there's been a lot of confusion about how the administration was supposed to distribute this. What their idea was they wanted to do something called test to treat. That means that if you went to, let's say, a CVS pharmacy, you went to their Minute Clinic and you got, you know, diagnosed with COVID, then you were supposed to be able to then right then and there get a course of this antiviral drug. Well, it didn't really get distributed as much as they wanted it to. And a lot of doctors are still under the impression that there's not enough of it. Well, there's a lot of it. It's available to people. It's just not they haven't done a great job of letting people know, you know, who's eligible, where to ask for it, where to get it. It's, you're right. It has been a real communications debacle.
Yep, it's a mess.
Yeah. So, but now you know you can.
I know now it's pronounced Paxlovid. I was calling it Paxlovid, but Jen Psaki said Paxlovid.
That's right. And if she says it, you know it's right.
It must be right. Second syllable.
Okay, you got it. Thank you so much for listening to the John Curley and Sherry Elicker Show. This hour is brought to you by Keel Mortgage at 1-888-778-KIEL. Thank you, Keel Mortgage. Hey, we'd love to hear from you. Why don't you write to us at mynorthwest.com? You can like us on Facebook, or you could follow us on Twitter at John and Sherry, spelled S-H-A-R-I. John is out today. Joining us is Cairo Radio's resident historian, Felix Bunnell. Hey, Felix, thanks again for being here.
You bet.
Did you, when you went to college, did you go to college? I don't know.
I didn't have that traditional, what they call in this article we're talking about, the full college experience.
Does that mean you didn't graduate, or you didn't really participate?
No, I graduated, but, you know, there was, nowadays, you know, my daughter is in college now, and we went through the whole, right before the pandemic, she started her freshman year in 2019, so she missed, she had her final year of high school before things went to hell. But they, you know, they take kids around now to look at campuses, and you visit these different places. You spend thousands of dollars just actually picking a college, and then you pay through the nose if you go to one of these very expensive schools. I just went to the UW. I never even considered any other school. I didn't make trips around. This is like 35 years ago. But it was just, you know, the University of Washington was like a public utility. That's the school you went to because, you graduated from high school in Kirkland. Of course you go to the University of Washington. And I worked the whole time I was in school, not always full time. But I didn't, I lived off campus in a shared house with some friends. It was really cheap to rent. And we weren't, there wasn't like crazy parties and that kind of thing. It was just sort of like, getting through it. It was like a box to check off and get on to the next thing. I wasn't big on the whole social part of the thing. It was more just sort of fulfilling a requirement so I could move on to getting a job. So it was very, it sounds very 19th century and hard scrabble to me. It really wasn't that. I mean, it was pretty soft, but nothing like what kids do nowadays, or at least before the pandemic. What about you?
Yeah, same exact experience. I went to the University of Maryland. You were either going to go to the University of Maryland, their College Park campus, or their Baltimore County campus. I went to the Baltimore County campus because I was a film major, and I wanted to be able to get into their film program because it was a little bit smaller. But number one, same deal. There was no question you were going to go to college. And number two, you were going to go to the University of Maryland because that was sort of right around the corner. And yeah, nobody cheap. Did this thing where you went on these wonderful adventures. Like, I have friends now whose kids, they're spending so much money taking them to visit these college, applying for the colleges, testing for everything. I mean, it's outrageous how much time, energy, and money goes into it. And there's an article in the Wall Street Journal about how now a lot of the colleges are rejecting kids at a higher rate than they used to. So for the 2021 academic year, about 130,000 students took what they called gap years. A gap year, for anybody that doesn't know this, is just a year that you take off. So that number has gone up from about 40 to 60,000 kids before the pandemic. And when they're taking their gap year, you'd think, like, I'm sure you had a friend or two that did this, where they'd get into school, they'd go the first year, and then they'd be like, I don't really know what I want to do. And their parents would say, if you don't stop failing your classes, we're not going to pay for it anymore. So they'd take like a year off to go work at Denny's, and then they'd come back and they'd go to the community college, and they kind of just got through it, whatever. These gap years that a lot of these kids are doing are just as expensive as college, they're going on, you know, big excursion programs, and they're people that are curating their gap years for them so they can have just the right resume to get into these schools. And we're talking about high-end schools, MIT, Stanford, you know, Princeton, Yale, all of those. So, you know, it's amazing. I think that parents are wealthy enough to do this and tolerant enough to kind of put up with it all.
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, anyone who faced the prospect of entering college in the fall of 2020, probably the worst year to go to college in living memory for anybody, right? You probably go back to the Depression or World War II to have circumstances that were so uncertain and so up in the air. And the idea of having to, like, pick some place that it's probably going to be expensive if you're going to a private school somewhere, and that may or may not even be in person. I mean, the schools that I know of from where my daughter was going and where friends' kids were going, they didn't reduce tuition because it was all classes were all being held via Zoom. I mean, their burn rate for what they were paying their staff and everything, that didn't change. So they were very happy not giving anybody kind of a discount. So I could see why kids would take a gap year and not even know they were taking a gap year, just essentially not going to school that year because you couldn't pick a place. But yes, this notion of the gap year counselor at some place called the Center for Interim Programs. That's the funniest named organization I've ever heard of. The Center for Interim Programs. It's like, well, how long is it going to last? I don't know. It's interim. You know, you have no idea. But yeah, this is sort of a slap in the face, where you're just trying to work enough or save enough money to pay for your kids to go to college. We only have the one child, so we fortunately were able to save a lot for her. But this notion of, like, these kids just sort of deciding to take these classes in, you know, like, there's something about an off-the-grid hiking program and a marine studies program over the summer. I mean, it's all about trying to get your kid well-positioned to earn, you know, a decent income so they don't have to to work at Denny's for the rest of their career.
Yeah,
right?
But when has a hiking program ever tipped the scales on anything? Oh, well, you know, she really wasn't a good candidate, but, you know, she climbed that rock wall, let's let her
in. Jenkins, wait, don't reject this one. Look what the gap year counselor at the Center for Interim Programs said about her.
I know. Well, one guy said, I thought this was really something. He said, you know, nobody's going to cure cancer in that year, and that no matter what they do, it's really not going to make that much of a difference. There's another article about, and this statistic, we talked a little bit about this in the pre-show meeting. I thought this statistic was really very low. Half the parents with children over 18 provide them with some financial support. I would have thought it was way higher than that, between college and just kids, you know, still living at home until they're 45 or whatever it is these days. I mean, it just seems like it would be a bigger number than half.
Yeah, I mean, that 18 number is awfully young. And you would think in this day and age, not necessarily a couple decades ago, but in this day and age, you're going to be shelling out money to support your kids at least into their early 20s, right? If they're going to school, if they're working maybe part-time to at least pay for some of their stuff, you're at least going to be shelling out some money. I think this number and this $1,000 a month average, which sounds low based on my personal experience, I think this is skewed by those people who are in their 30s and 40s who are living back at home. And, you know, I took a couple years off from my full college experience. I lived on the East Coast, and I came back here when I was, I think, 22 or 23. And I lived at home for a while, and it was great. I was so glad to have a place to kind of land after being away for a couple of years. So it's weird, the stigma or the shame, right? It's all that the pandemic just blew all that stuff out of the water. It's like there's sort of, it's a whole new game. You can kind of, if your parents are willing to pay for you or support you, it doesn't seem like there's the shame around it that there would have been even, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Oh, no, it's pretty typical. Were you part of the 62% that didn't contribute anything when they lived at home?
Well, I mean, I mowed the lawn.
I know I was part of that. I did nothing. I didn't
turn
pay anything.
Turn the porch light on at night and stuff, you know?
Right. I was a complete deadbeat. My parents were so generous. So,
yeah.
Well, we'll see. To the John Curley and Sherry Elliger Show. Thanks so much for being here today. John's out today, and joining us is Cairo Radio's resident historian, Felix Bunnell. Felix, are you a fan of what they're calling cringe comedy?
You know, I look at the list of the shows. The one that I've watched probably more than any of these is The Office. And I came to The Office pretty late, like about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something like that. And I watched it, you know, from start to finish. And then went back and watched some of the episodes over and over again. And I love that stuff. I think it's funny. It's certainly it's better than most of the other sitcoms. If you look at sort of the non-cringe comedy sitcoms, it passes sort of the popular shows these days with the bad laugh tracks and everything. So, yeah, I count myself among the cringe comedy fans for sure.
Well, this what they're calling cringe comedy is really this sort of really deep definition. It's a feeling of embarrassment you get when watching someone behave in an embarrassing way. It's a little bit different than slapstick because you're not really laughing at someone. You're laughing at the situation. So you brought up The Office. Let's listen to an example of cringe comedy. This is an episode where Michael Scott promises a class of students that he's going to be paying for their tuition, and they are very excited about that.
Hey, Mrs. Scott, what you gonna do? What you gonna do to make our dreams come true? Hey, Mrs. Scott, what you gonna do? What you gonna do to make our dreams come true?
You came into a life and made a promise that made us honest, made us realize we don't need to compromise because we can have it all. Because you made it possible for us to achieve the improbable. Hey!
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 Hey! Hey, Mrs. Scott, what you gonna do? What you gonna do? Make our dreams come true.
Okay, here comes the cringe part when he tells them, wah, wah, can't pay.
I am so proud of all of you. Derek and LaFerve and Ben and Ayana and Michaela and Nikki and Jason and I'm sorry, okay, sorry spacing your name.
I'm Zion. I'm Michaela's younger brother.
Well, Zion, I am not going to be paying for your tuition. Which brings me to my main point, and that is that I will not be able to pay for anybody's tuition. I'm so, so sorry.
Steve Carell does that better than anybody.
Right. Well, people would say that Curb Your Enthusiasm is also super cringe comedy. This is a Curb Your Enthusiasm coach bathroom scene. Let's take a
listen. Excuse me. Do you mind my asking where you're going?
Oh, I was going to go to the bathroom.
This bathroom is for coach passengers only.
Really? Who said that?
Earlier, I tried to use the one up there, and I was told that, you know, coach isn't allowed to use first class, so we have our different areas.
I am so sorry that they did that. That's terrible.
Thank you for understanding.
Well, I understand, and I empathize with you that you weren't allowed to do that, but I'm still going to use the bathroom.
Why?
I didn't stop you from using that bathroom.
Because you're in first class, so you get to do whatever you want to do.
Not at all.
You get on first, you get free drinks, you get a hot towel.
No. Just because I'm sitting up there, you're making a generalization about me, but I'm not like a first class person. I'm coaching.
Really, maybe it's just that you're not acting coachy.
I didn't
stop
you.
You're not acting coachy.
I'm coachy.
No, but you just think you get to walk back here.
You got it all wrong, okay?
Oh, I'm sure that I do.
You'd be up in first class if somebody bought you a ticket. You'd be up there in a second.
Class.
Oh, poor little coaching girl. She's so jealous.
Okay, so, of course, because we have to analyze everything, there's something called benign violation hypothesis. And what that is, and this is why we laugh at that, it's because we laugh at moral or social situations which are benign and safe. So no one's really getting hurt. And it's not us, so we feel safe enough to laugh at it.
We can identify it. Also, I think in both of those shows, whether it's Steve Carell playing Michael Scott or Larry David, those are such well-crafted shows. The character is so clear. The character development is so strong. I mean, if someone had never watched either of those shows and listened to those clips, it wouldn't be that funny because you don't really know the depth of the backstory of the
right.
character. You don't know how this character is always finding himself in these situations and how he's always able to get out of them or always is sort of always humiliated this way. I mean, it goes back to that really kind of the strong era of really good comedy writers going back to the 30s and 40s when you had people like Jack Benny doing stuff on the radio that was just sustained over time, really good character development that made, you know, just a single word or a glance or whatever funny because you knew what the character was thinking based on how much you empathized with them because you liked them and they were so well developed. I think that's the secret of really good television.
Yeah. So do we have time? I got to hear this because this is Jacob's favorite show. And I want to look into the pull back the curtain of Jacob and see what this is. Do we have time to play this one, Jacob?
We'll start it. And, you know, when you're cringing enough, we just have me stop, I guess, is what
we're saying. All right. When you're cringing enough, you stop it. So go ahead. This is from Nathan for you.
Oh, yeah. I should explain. So it's the main character of the show. These are all real people to some extent. His name is Nathan. He's pitching a marketing idea to a dating website CEO.
The main reason most women are afraid to use online dating is because they think the person they meet up with could potentially be a killer and murder them.
I don't know that that's a big reason that women don't sign up for dating sites. We haven't had women contacting us, hey, I met this guy on your site and he was a creep and this and that happened.
Well, you might not hear from those women because...
I don't think that is it's certainly a concern.
The solution... is daddy's watching.
Okay.
Up until age 18, most women have a daddy keeping tabs on any man she goes out with. But once she gets bigger, daddy's no longer around, but danger still is. So if Dating DNA offered a security service where female users could request to have someone secretly watch over their first dates, the website would quickly become the obvious choice for women looking to date online, because they know that daddy's watching.
It seems a little condescending to me to women.
I think we're out of time, but that's
good.
The gist.
I've never heard that show before or seen it, and that's funny. That's good writing. It's good stuff.
Nathan, for you, where is this on? How can we find
it? It's been off the air for some time now. It was on Comedy Central.
Thanks, Jacob.
Yeah, right. Oh, well. Hey, there's that canceled show that Jacob loves. All righty, then.